Again, we're here for the NARPM Presents session, Utilizations of the U.S. EPA Environmental Response Team's Mobile Trace Atmospheric Gas Analyzer, or TAGA, laboratories to address environmental issues. We'll be joined today by Dave McCunis, who comes to us from EPA's Environmental Response Team. Dave, pardon me, has been there for some time, but I believe perhaps just in the interest of time, Dave, I may cut your bio short and let you fill in the audience with your background while we get your screen up there. So, Dave, I have changed things around. You should be able to share your screen with us in real time, and I will confirm once it is up for everyone here today. And again, we apologize to the audience for the slight delay in getting this set up, but, Dave, we can now see your screen. And you can feel free to turn on the presentation view when you're ready. And then we'll minimize. There you go. And perfect. We can see everything, so feel free to begin.
Okie doke. Thank you so much, Jean. Thank you for doing all that for me. Today I'm going to talk to you a little bit about the Mobile Trace Atmospheric Gas Analyzer Laboratories, or the TAGAs. The U.S. EPA procured its first TAGA laboratory in 1984, and it was equipped with just one instrument. It was equipped with a single MFMS system. And to almost carbon date myself, that system used to use liquid helium and as a refrigerant to cool the interior of the mass spectrometer to actually create the vacuum. It would freeze out all the gases in the air. We would operate that instrument between 15 and 20 degrees K. So that's about 253 to 258 minus 258 degrees Celsius. And because we would freeze out all the gases, it used to have to defrost it every day. And so once it reached ambient temperature, it took about 6 hours to pump back down. Well, a lot's changed since the advent of high-efficiency, low-speed turbos, better electronics, and better computer systems. And that's what I'm going to talk to you about today is the new TAGA systems. So the new TAGA systems, we have three mobile systems. We have the truck at the top, and we have two buses on the left-hand lower. We also have a trailer that we can put one on a cart inside of and drive it to a location, but the two buses and the truck are what we normally take out into the field. And those vehicles are located in Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, Edison, New Jersey, and Las Vegas, Nevada. So what is the TAGA laboratories? This is, right here is the picture of the MFMS system, the mass spectrometer system. And one of the things I want you to notice is that it has no gas chromatograph in the front of it. So it doesn't have that as a separation technique, but we actually use the mass filters as our separation technique. And notice that this hose is connected to the front end. Well, gases are pulled through this hose at about 90 liters per minute, and then a representative sample is brought into the source at about 10 mils per minute. So the readings are a constant update of what we're doing, and as we travel through the streets or if we're just sitting in one location or we're using a hose to go into people's homes, we're getting a constant update of what's being presented to the mass spectrometer. So how does this work? This is a little animation. And one of the things that what it does is that when the gases are pulled into the source, it goes into an area where they get ionized. Once they become ions, they can be affected by electrical or magnetic fields. So this first area that they call a quadrupole is nothing more than a mass filter. We're filtering out the masses. So if I use TCE, which seems to be a compound of concern nowadays, we would set the first filter to only allow 130 to go through it. And that is TCE with all the chlorines being chlorine 35. But chlorine actually exists at two isotopes in nature, chlorine-35 and chlorine-37. And they actually occur in a 3-to-1 ratio, with chlorine-35 being the most abundant. So if I set this to only allow chlorine-35 to pass through, 129 and below and 131 and above is electronically discriminated. So I bring it into the second location, and I'm introducing nitrogen gas. So as the nitrogen gas collides with these ions, they form fragments. But they don't form fragments randomly. They form fragments in a manner that can best stabilize the charge, and which is, for this particular compound, a loss of a chlorine, and it'd be a loss of a chlorine-35. So I set the second mass filter here to only allow compounds that have that weigh 95 to pass through it. So 94 and below and 96 and above are discriminated electronically, and we let that parent-daughter ion pair strike the multiplier, and we measure it for 100 milliseconds, or a tenth of a second. So to look at TCE, the 130-95 would be where all the chlorines are 35, and there's a loss of one of the chlorines. And you can see that this line goes up and down with the 132-95, which would be one of the chlorines is a chlorine-37, and we're looking at a loss of chlorine-37 to form the 95. So they both rise and fall together. For this may look as though we're measuring TCE, but we use a number of different ions, including 132-95, which means that one of the parents would have one chlorine-37 in it, and we'd look at a loss of a 35. Notice that this is down here on the bottom. Whoops. And so these ions do not rise and fall with this. This, what we're seeing here, is not TCE. When we introduce the standard at the end to show that the instrument is functioning properly, notice the blue line is coincidental with the other two ions. This is TCE. To get a different look at this, the 132-97 shows no increase at all during the monitoring. These two ions do. Therefore, this compound is not the compound that we suspected, but is something else. That's how we use the sensitivity and the selectivity to actually do the monitoring with this particular instrument. So we also have other instruments in the TAGA mobile laboratory, and one of them is a GC with a loop injection. And what we can do with this is we can collect Tedlar bag samples and inject them on a loop injection system, and they will be separated out by a chromatographic column, and we analyze them with a single filter mass spectrometer. What this looks like with the loop injection is that when we're in the load position, we can put the internal standard on in this 50 microliter loop and put the sample on in the 5 milliliter loop. And then when we get ready to inject it onto the column, we switch this to this configuration. The carrier gas now is going to go through the 50 microliter loop, flushing out the internal standard, going into the 5-mil loop, flushing out that sample, and placing it onto the column. The advantage of using this particular technique instead of using a trap is that if you contaminate your trap, you cannot do any additional samples until that trap is cleared. With this, instead of loading on a nominal volume of 500 milliliters or 1,000 milliliters like you would with using method TO15 with Summa canisters, we load on 5 milliliters of our sample. So we have far less that we're loading onto the column. We're also constantly flushing this for the entire run, which is quite abbreviated compared to a normal TO15 run. Our runs are only about 8 minutes. So you can actually not have carryover problems. You can have a much shorter run. We can't do some of the lower vapor pressure compounds like naphthalene using this technique, but we can go all the way out to, say, PERC, which is tetrachloroethene, and that works very well with this system. Additionally, since we're not going down to the very low levels, we have our detection limit for our target compounds is 500 parts per trillion, and we have a dynamic range that goes out 5 orders of magnitude, and our upper standard is 10 parts per million by volume. This method is NELAC accredited also, so it has the same QA requirements as a sample that you would send off to a laboratory. The calibration range for a typical mass spectrometer, GC mass spectrometer doing method TO15 only goes out to being about 20 parts per billion. So anything above 20 parts per billion, you have to start making dilutions on. So we've used this instrument to support emergency responses throughout the United States. In New Jersey, there was a train wreck in Paulsboro, New Jersey, as the train was going across the bridge. And if you look at the left-hand corner, this picture, that red dot, shows you the bridge that it went across. That swing bridge was built back in the 1800s and apparently malfunctioned, and you had a number of train cars go off, and those included not only ethanol, but several vinyl chloride train cars, and at least one of them had breached. So the neighborhoods that were surrounding the swing bridge had to be evacuated or sheltered in place. So we provided the command structure there with the analytical data as we drove through the area so they can make decisions on whether to tell the folks to shelter in place or if they needed to be evacuated. Additionally, there was a large oil spill in Region 5 in Marshall, Michigan, where the Enbridge pipeline had a breach in it. In the lower left-hand corner shows you the breach of the pipeline. This caused diluted bitumen oils to be spilled into the creek, which went into the river. And unlike some of the other offshore oil spills that we've contended with, you have population that went down and along the entire length of the river. So we provided information as far as the benzene concentration in the air, which was the compound that was leading the risk assessment or driving the risk assessment. We also were involved with a deep water horizon spill, and even though that they were burning off material out at sea, we were actually involved with monitoring the coastline all the way from Panama City to the island at the bottom of Louisiana. Panama City is actually in Florida, so we'd spend 1 week in looking at Florida and Alabama and Mississippi, and the next week we'd look at Mississippi and Louisiana. So we monitored this from April until September, when it was capped and deemed that the emergency was over. We've been involved with hurricanes. This is pictures of Hurricane Katrina and Rita. And if you look at down here in the bottom, they have a train. But if you look at it more closely, the cars are derailed. They're pulled off the tracks. Some of the materials are spilled onto the tracks. There's other facilities that were leaking or had been damaged. This is a Superdome over here. And it was, we were monitoring to see what was actually in the ambient air during this particular time. We also did Hurricane Harvey down in Texas, and we monitored around the refineries. We did almost all the refineries, I believe, on the eastern side of the state of Texas. And we can do this because we simply monitored around them in real time, and we updated our signal probably about every 5 yards. So we had a considerable amount of data for the locations that we were monitoring around. And we also have been involved with some explosions and fires. This was in Region 5 at the EQ Resources in Romulus. And we monitored the neighborhoods that are adjacent to this recycler. We are looking for solvents that may still be, that hadn't been volatilized often in the flames and were still emitting from the area. The TAGA Mobile Laboratory has been involved with vapor intrusion. We use the TAGA monitoring to go into different structures, whether they be homes or government structures or schools or businesses. This gives us a lot of information. And if you look closely, you can see this hose that's in front of the home. And we take readings before we go inside to make sure that there's no outside ambient impact. And then we go inside of the residence and go into each one of the rooms. I have a short animation here, and I'll speed this up a little bit. As we go inside the house, each one of these circles represent us spending 1 minute in these rooms. Most homes, unless there's a source in them, actually show a very clear location where it may be entering the home, but it's evenly distributed throughout the rest of the home. So as we go through these different locations, we go into this closet area underneath the steps coming down. And inside this closet area was actually the infrastructure that was bringing in the water, that was bringing in natural gas, you know, like the electrical into the home. So as we go through the rest of the downstairs, we went back out to the garage and noticed that it goes back down to basically outside levels. And this is due to the fact that garages are very, they're not very airtight, so they get a lot of ventilation in them, and it ventilates to whatever is in the outside ambient air. As we go back and do a further inspection in the closet, you can see as we get close to the walls that are the increases on the TCE and the 111 trichloroethane both rise up. And then as we finish this, we take the hose back outside and we will spike the instrument with a known standard, and we'll be able to say that where we should put in our samples or what else needs to be looked at. But one of the things I want to show you is that that vapor intrusion only took about 35 minutes. So it's a very quick way of doing an analysis inside of a vapor intrusion study. So at the end of it, we did the spike, the instrument worked well, and then we can move on to the next location. We can also use the GC with the loop injection to look at samples that are collected from sub-slab samples, from whether it be from a building or from a residence. We can collect them in we can collect them in Tedlar bags. You can collect them in Summa canisters. But one of the things I wanted to bring out here is that notice the TCE concentration in the Tedlar bags versus the Summa canisters. And if you look at it, when I took all the samples all the way out to over 40,000 parts per billion, 40,000 parts per billion, and looked at the TAGA results, it doesn't show quite as good a line as when we knock off the upper points. But as we get lower and lower, the Tedlar bags have better and better agreement. This is because, at least I believe it's because, the dilutions that the GCMS must make on the nominal sample that they injected are going to be less accurate than when they put on the entire, you know, like 500 mils or liter. So if you have to dilute it 2,000 times and you're putting on 500 milliliters, what you're actually putting on your GC column when you have a sample this high is only about 250 microliters. So it's a very small injection, and it means that your injection capabilities have to be very good. So I believe that the TAGA with mobile laboratories with its GCMS using a loop injection, where we can calibrate without any dilutions out to 10 parts per million or 10,000 parts per billion, is a very good way to go. And again, this is NELAC accredited for these compounds, so we have the same QA as the Sumacanister analysis using method TO15. So how can we use this in a larger building? This building was a site up in New York, in Vestal, and we put in a sub-slab points on each of these locations. We put in some that followed a grid pattern, then we had some discretionary, and then we also put in just some random samples. What we actually found with this, we knew that this area on the right-hand side was impacted, but we did not know over here on the left-hand side that this area was impacted. We ran all of these samples in one day, and we can have very good results. We also took Sumacanisters, and the data compared very well to one another. What this also shows you is that if you're going to do remediation on this building, then you want to concentrate in this area, and you won't have to worry about, you know, like the other areas. And then you might want to better define this area and find out where you need to do your remediation there. So you save yourself a lot of time and money by isolating the location of your source. We've also used this for urban air toxic program, where we monitored down in Houston Ship Channel, and we would monitor around refineries, and we'd look at emissions that were coming off of the facilities and impacting locations on the adjacent streets. So you can see right here up around letters C and D that the benzene concentration got up to about 80 parts per billion on the streets. That's above an acceptable level. So if you have this information, what you can do when you have this wind pattern as well is that you can say, okay, where is the source of my emissions, and then help to identify that, and the industry can use that information to then better control this area in case there was to alleviate the emissions coming off. We can also put other instrumentation on the vehicle and monitor at the same time that we're using the TAGA mass spec. We put a Lumex on here, and we are going by this chloralkali plant. What we're actually seeing here is a very nice Gaussian distribution, and this is about 3,000 nanograms per cubic meter. They did not realize that they were losing this amount of mercury to the environment, and that their control mechanisms were not working appropriately. I think subsequently they've changed this particular operation and they no longer use mercury. So this is an animation. This is what you would see if we were driving around with the TAGA. Up here in the upper left-hand corner, we're going to be monitoring benzene. Over here is methyltert-butyl ether. Down here in the right-hand lower corner is styrene. Over here is xylene. So when we get to this location, we get an increase in styrene. Notice that even though that styrene is only basically one atomic mass unit away from xylene, we don't have any interferences. And since we don't have a GC front end, this is important because we don't have anything to separate out the columns before they actually go into the analyzer themselves. So I'm going to speed this up just a little bit. And as you can see, as we move over to a different location over here, you can see that benzene, this is 200 parts per billion of benzene that's escaping from the tanks right there. So as we continue this along, you can see that MTBE is rising, that we're now seeing some xylene again, that the benzene's also come back down, and the MTBE has risen up even further. So this gives you a very quick way, in less than 45 minutes, to look through this whole area and to find out what is actually going into the environment. One of the advantages of this, hopefully, would be you could tell the manufacturers that they're losing their finish in raw products, and they would take action. And then if they take action, then we have, as far as the EPA goes, we have a cleaner atmosphere and better health conditions, and that's what we're all striving for. We were involved with the anthrax remediation fumigation. This is the Senate Hart Building. And in 2001, we left the World Trade Center, where we were using the GCMS to look at gases coming off of the pile and trying to identify compounds to help the fire department to get a better idea on what personal protection that they should use, particularly in the line of respirators. The state people were particularly concerned at the World Trade Center because they had an awful lot of Freon, and in the heat, they were afraid that it would turn into phosgene and cause additional issues. So we monitored around the Hart Center building. They had decided that they were going to actually fumigate with chlorine dioxide. And we had not ever monitored for chlorine dioxide, but we took this opportunity to do so. And as you can see, the chlorine dioxide was observed as we went along this area over here around Flag K and not elsewhere. And that's when we are downwind of the Hart Building. And the reason that this is actually kind of important is not that just that the fumigant was escaping, but if the anthrax was re-aerosolizable, which what you want if it's a military grade to affect the enemy, but if we're seeing the fumigant out in the street, are we also not seeing the anthrax potentially coming out to the street as well? So we used this information so they could actually take that vent that was on top of the building and seal that off. It was actually a vent from the bathroom in the Daschle suite. Also, we looked at chlorine because a breakdown product of chlorine dioxide, which we had to actually make on site by taking chlorine and bubbling it through a sodium chloride solution, is also a degradation product. Chlorine is a degradation product that you have to be concerned with because chlorine dioxide is very unstable. Pre-deployments. We're often asked to be at pre-deployments in case there's an issue. We've been at the Summit of Eight, All-Star Baseball Games, Super Bowls, Pocono 500s, NATO, election inaugurations of both the Republican and the Democratic conventions, just to name a few. Research and development operations. One of the things that we want to do is, yes, we can do this right now, but OSCs and RPMs, our clients on the Superfund side, are always looking for additional things that we can do. One of the research operations that we conducted was with the Environment Canada. Now they're called Environment Canada and Climate Change. And we did this at the Suffield, Alberta, Canada facility. And what we are doing up here is that this facility down in the lower left-hand side, this little trailer, they were using it as a building that was contaminated, and they were looking at different ways to see if it was properly decontaminated. So what they were using is a surrogate for nerve agents, and the surrogate that they were looking at was dimethylmalonate, which is actually the smell that you get from green apple. And for the folks that are interested in what the structure looks like, it's up here, up above there. Anyways, it's a very simple molecule. So what we did was we actually drove back and forth while they were doing operations up here in this facility, like that, whether it be spraying on the chemical and or deconning the chemical and what it was beforehand. So down here in the bottom, you can actually see we're looking at the material, and we're actually before they started the operations for 25 minutes, and then we continued monitoring after that. And along the y-axis, we're looking at parts per trillion, but it's actually thousands. So this is in parts per billion by volume. So this is what the structure looked like, the TAGA moving back and forth, and they were taking other measurements, whether it be handheld or they were taking samples from inside, and all their equipment is set up on these tables here. So when we went back and forth, you know, like that, this is the entire time that the operation went on. You can see that it's very sharp Gaussian plumes. So one of the things that we are looking at is going, well, if it's a pretty much a ground level release and it's a Gaussian shaped, maybe we could use the Aloha model and run it backwards by putting in what we have at a certain location and then determining what the emission rate should be. And that's what we did with this. So at different times of the operation, we had the concentration that was observed, the centerline maximum. We knew how far we were away because we had GPS going. We had met conditions, both wind speed and direction. We knew what the temperature was outside. And with all this, we can determine what the emission rate was. So this is the first time that we tried to look at the emission rate, but we really didn't know how much was coming off. So this we just assumed was a good best guess. As far as building clearances, we actually worked with ORD, and we were working with the Homeland Security Research Center on a number of buildings, but this by far was the largest one. This is the St. John Regional Medical Center in Oxnard, California. This building is not white. This building had been tarped, and every one of these, this white, or every bit of this white structure is the plastic tarp that was almost shrink-wrapped to this building. They used the inside air handling system to give it a nice tight fit. One of the things that they did with this building is that they, instead of anthrax, they were looking at mold. So they were doing a mold remediation in this building, but we were examining containment inside this building. So we drove around the outside of this building during the fumigation, and then after the fumigation, they were required to see if what the concentration was inside of the building, and it had to be less than 2 parts per billion. We were actually thinking about going inside there and doing this test beforehand, but now it became a critical so people could get back inside, reclaim their spore strips, look at how well the fumigation worked, and then put this hospital back into service, because this is the only critical care facility in Oxnard, California. So we have this is the TAGA. We put the nitrogen gas in the cylinder here. We have an air motor. We also have a UPS, an uninterruptible power supply, on board there that after we got it up to the building and we were ready to unhook the umbilical cord to a generator, we would go on to the UPS system. And then we had power as we walked the system through the facility. This is another animation. I'll make this real brief as well. We went inside the facility, and as we went down into the basement, which was the highest levels that we saw, you'll notice up here that we see a spike. And we went back again and looked at that spike and found out that spike was actually caused by these floor scrubber units. They had water reservoirs on the back of them. And one of the things about chlorine dioxide, it solubilizes in water and then it releases itself over time. So we knew that was where it was coming from, and that those were just two spikes that were not associated above the 3 parts per billion that we had to be concerned about. So notice that up here, that this is about this right there with this peak, which is about 2 parts per billion. When we drove or pulled the cart around again, it replicated about 2 parts per billion. We checked out all the hallways and went into some of the rooms, and then finally came back over to here, and we did this whole operation in about 13 minutes. So we were able to clear this area, have a high degree of confidence that the chlorine dioxide was below what we needed to be concerned with, which is far below the IDLH or even the TWA. So we were able to do this work very quickly, and they could go back in and start the next step of their operation. Well, if you ever pulled stuff or pushed stuff, especially when it weighs about 1,000 pounds, you realize that if you were on SCBA, like bottled air, that you'd blow through it pretty quickly. So we actually got this cart puller. It's sort of like a grocery cart puller that you see, except this one's kind of on steroids. And now we can pull this through the entire building without expending as much energy. And we don't need to have 3 people on board to push this while you have somebody actually operating it. So you reduce the number of people that would be placed into a situation that may be hazardous. And that's always a goal, is to minimize the number of people that you send downfield. Building clearances for nerve agents. We actually work with Battelle, the National Homeland Security Research Center down here. I was involved with the very first deliverable, which was to check the TAGA with chemical warfare agents. They use Battelle National Laboratories because they had access to the surety agents. And we found that it had excellent sensitivity to all of the agents. In fact, some of the persistent agents, we could see it without having to change it over to an analog, which means that we have better capabilities than what you might expect to be able to find in a fixed laboratory. This is us taking our instrument up to ECBC, which is Edgewater Chemical Biological Center, that's run by the Army, and we tested ours using syringe drives at a diluted into an airflow that diluted the sample even further, So we are down in parts per billion or parts per trillion or parts per quadrillion level. So here's the United States Army public health chart for chemical warfare agents. We took this information, compared it to the TAGA information. This is our detection levels, our, excuse me, detection limits for, and we only looked at three when we were up there, for sulfur mustard, GB, which is also called sarin, and VX, which is called something else that I won't try to repeat it right now. And as you can see, that our detection levels are very far below the IDLH, the cell, the workplace level. The only thing that they're not below, and these are instantaneous readings, is below a general population that would be collected over 24 hours. And yet, they're very close to it. And if we had more time, we could zero in on this and increase or lower our detection levels and increase our sensitivity on a compound-specific basis. If you look at other compound action levels, like the acute exposure guideline levels, level 1, 2, and 3, these levels are way above what we're able to look at. So remember, we had that on a cart. What we could do is take the take some heated glass tubing, move it down by the floor, and actually look at readings coming off the floor and get what would be the, after they've already cleaned it up, mind you, to give them better insurance or security or confidence, I guess is the best word, to believe that that they had done a good job. Also, they could check our zeros with traditional white methods, as well as where we saw elevated readings using, and they could check those. So you check the positive and the negative using their techniques. This is just a screening technique. The reason I believe that we can do this is that we took subway materials from the New York subway, the door rubber, fabric, window rubber, and tile, and put these coupons into culture tubes. We actually did spike them with small levels of material and then just simply opened them up into the front of the air intake for the TAGA and looked to see if we could see anything. So for sarin, say, this is the tile coupon, this is the fabric coupon, this is the window rubber coupon, and this is the door rubber compound. And you can see what the concentrations, this is just in intensity, but we've also run a calibration curve. So what's coming off of there would be about 500 parts per trillion to one part per billion. So the loading that we put on there was 2 microliters of 100 nanogram per mil standard. So the amount of sarin that we put on there was 200 nanograms. So if you look at it per, you know, like amount of mass per square centimeter, it's about 38 nanograms per square centimeter. And this is being done in real time. We looked at all four of those. This is before we started the experiment, a minute into it. We opened up the tile, another minute into it. We opened up the fabric, another minute into it. We opened up the window rubber coupon, about another 30 seconds into it. We opened up the door rubber. So this is how this instrument can be used if we ended up having one of these incidents. Bakken oil was a very big issue not very long ago. We were looking at workers' health and safety. One of the situations that we looked at was at the OMSET testing center in Leonardo, New Jersey. This is actually, over here on the left-hand side, about 600 feet long. This is a great facility. And one of the things that we did was we ran bag samples next to their handheld instruments, so we had that comparison. Then we also ran the TAGA back and forth along the side of a the tank, and we measured us going in and out of the plume. And benzene is going to be the risk driver, so we looked at the concentration in near field, what this would be. So just to give you an idea what it would look like, is that we have the oil released here, and I'm just going to speed this up a little bit. And as you can see with time, the oil starts to cover the pond. There's a boom behind this bridge right here, and there's a boom here. So all the oil is being contained inside this boomed area. And this is the taga that's going back and forth, and these are the folks that are looking at multi-rays, the benzene, ray, different types of instrumentation. And we would take a bag sample next to them with a Tedlar bag and then run it on the GCMS inside the taga. So that's how we actually collected the information when we were doing this study. So this is what it looked like when we were going in and out of the plume as a function of the wind speed and direction. But notice that the benzene starts off, and as the pool gets covered, it rises up, and then it decreases, not linearly, but almost exponentially. So this gave us a good idea how long benzene would be staying in the air. On the left-hand side is the concentrations in parts per billion, and on the x-axis is the time of the day or the time into the run. We started about 10:15 in the morning, and we finished about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. So we wanted to see, that was actually conducted at about 20 degrees F. We wanted to see what would happen if we conducted something similar, much smaller, when we are doing it during the summertime, because train wrecks don't know seasons. So this is a 10 by 10 foot pool, and they filled up this pool with a 55 gallon drum of oil. They knew that what the concentration was in the oil, which is about 1200 parts per million. There was a number of different instruments that were stationed around here, but we also had a fellow right there walking back and forth downwind of this plume to see if we could, what it would look like, and if we could use the same idea of walking through the plume and trying to figure out what the emission rate was. So there's the two pools. This is the path that we are taking. We took different paths depending on the wind direction, but this is the one that we did the day that we collected the information for the modeling. And as we walked through the plume, we had a nice Gaussian distribution if there wasn't any perturbations, and the walk was fast enough that and the wind was steady enough, it gives you a very nice Gaussian distribution. If we took all of these runs and all the times that we went through it when we got the maximum concentration, which is at the top of these peaks, and you were to strip away all the other data, you would get this as far as the maximum concentration observed between on each one of the paths. If you take that and convert it into and run the Aloha model backwards, you would get the emission rate. Well, if you sum up all the emission rates for the 1 minute that it took the fellow to walk back and forth, and we knew what the initial benzene in the oil was, I thought I told you 1,200, but if you take the 1,200 parts per billion, and you convert it into grams, knowing the size of the drum, 55 gallons, you know that there'd be 209 grams in the drum. We look at the emission rate, and we ended up with 255. We look at the concentration in the water, and since it went down to background, we can assume that the concentration in the oil is non-existent. The model only over-predicted it at 23%. So Perhaps this could be used to model other incidences. So this gave us a first time when we knew what the concentration was in the oil, what we were seeing as far as emission rates, summing that over those the time period, and also measuring the other location where the oil could have migrated off to, and that being the water column. One of the other things that we did with the TAGA is we interfaced it with a geoprobe membrane interface, and we took it to a site and wanted to see how well it would work out. We don't have a good way to calibrate the concentrations observed in the soil column, but when we get into the groundwater area, we thought that if we took the standard and we inverted it and we measured it across this membrane, we would be able to maybe calculate what the concentration should be. So we created a calibration curve by looking at different concentrations of PCE in the standards, and then we wanted to see, well, how well did they respond, how well did our measurements, if we took a real live sample and compared it to fixed laboratories. Well, here's our geoprobe, here's region 4 data, and it has pretty good comparison. Here's the contract using the same method, 8260, that the lab used, and their data doesn't compare as well. So we thought, well, maybe this has a possibility. So how about if we did it in situ? So we went down to a site, we used the geoprobe, and we took a stream off of the geoprobe. They ran half of it through their three instruments, which is a PID, an FID, and an XSD, which measures chlorinated compounds. And we mixed ours with air so we could get the right ionization capability because we calibrated in air. And this is what the table looked like. This here is the PID from the geoprobe. This is the XSD from the geoprobe. This EC is just electroconductivity. This talks about the soil. This is the temperature that we observed. This is the information that we had previously. This is the screened interval. This is the distance to the groundwater. So some of the screen is actually above the screen interval some of it is above the water table. And we took this information. So what we saw was when we ran the sample, the 8260 that they got for PCE, they got 23.3 parts per million. When we did it, like that, just putting it on the probe outside, ex situ, we got 29 parts per million. That's pretty good agreement. Now, as we go down through the water table, you can see that averaged over the screen interval with the water, the PCE was about 119. Now, we're not exactly in that column, like that. We're not in the well itself. We're about 5 feet. If you look at this drawing, here's the well that they took a sample out of. Here's where we're taking or placing the geoprobe. If you look at the instantaneous maximum over the screen interval, it would be about 840, and that's in agreement with this right there. If you look at the TAGA at where they took their sample, like that, as we're driving it through, we're at about 313. What this actually tells you is that they have a very long screened interval, but they're only collecting water in this part of the interval. So whatever is coming out over here, if they make their screen interval smaller, they may actually be able to remediate this area more effectively. But more importantly, what I see this being used for, and I'm not a geologist, so I spoke to them, is that you could use this information to site your wells better. So wells are very expensive. We did three of these in a day, so this doesn't take very much time. So this may also give you information when you have commingled plumes on who's responsible for what. That's something that we'd like to look at in the future as well. Perfluoro compound analysis. There's a lot of interest in the water. However, you know, like that, nobody's looking at the air. One of the things that we did, and this is in the very beginning stages, so we still have a lot of work to do, is that we looked at perfluoro. This is a heated glass transfer line, and we injected sample in through using a syringe drive, and this is a GC injector port that we had built up, and there's a glass tube. One of the things that we learned is that the glass tubing is susceptible for this material to reside on it. It takes a while for it to come off of it. So again, we're pulling through here at about 90 liters per minute, and we're injecting here depending on what rate we chose for the syringe drive. But we're also flushing. What we did was, since this is a syringe drive, we're taking advantage of being able to flush out the syringe drive using nitrogen. So we're constantly moving that gas stream into this gas stream. So this is GenX. This is one of the compounds that we're looking at down here in North Carolina. There's a plant down here that's been using this material, and it's being found on and off site, and we believe that it may be due to air deposition, not just simply being moved off with the groundwater. However, you know, like, more work needs to be done on that as well. So this is our calibration curve. This is intensity is in ion counts per second. And this is in parts per trillion. Now, we only had a few days to look at this, and this is looking at a parent ion only, no daughters, and we're looking at it in the negative ion mode. There's not very many compounds that like negative ion modes, and this compound is one that really likes it. So maybe with more work, we can actually do some of this, you know, be able to monitor the air very effectively. One of the other things that we're noticing is that there's papers out that it comes off of landfills, and it comes off of sewage treatment plants. So maybe there's something that's involved with Superfund along those lines. One of the things that we wanted to look at too is that it's really great to have all this information where we're at. However, you know, like that, we're not the decision makers. We need to get this to people that can view it in a manner that can be intuitively obvious. They can present it to people less knowledgeable, but yet very concerned. A lot of your political people may not understand micrograms per cubic meter, parts per billion, but if you can show them that it's below their action levels and give them, you know, like an easy to read illustration, that goes a long way. So we have actually taken the TAGA data, and we've actually connected it to VIPER, which was no easy task using the old computer systems that we must use because of the software for running the instrument, and being able to ship it off to any place, any EOC, any a political person, any decision maker, whether they be in Washington or in the EOC in the region, whatever. And we utilize this technique with the VIPER deployment manager. So what this does is lists off all the compounds that we're interested in doing. So if I click on this point right there, it will actually tell you what the concentrations are for each of the compounds that we're looking at. If I click above it, it will take this map up here, this Google map, and show you where that was actually collected at. So you have tremendous capabilities. You can put alarm levels on here. You can say, okay, I've exceeded low levels, high levels, and make decisions. Also take actions, you know, like out in the field, whether or not to stay there longer or to investigate further, and to help out your decision makers back in headquarters in the EOC in the regions. So at the end of the day, you know, like that, they took these graphs where all the locations that we drove, compared them to the action levels that were established, and instead of a blue line, they gave it a green line, but I had it in blue, so that's what you guys get, unfortunately. And that's very illustrative to a non-technical audience. So this is another advantage that we've come across with in the recent past. It's another advantage that we provide for the regions. As far as we spoke about this before, we are accredited with the TAGA for two compounds, PCE and TCE, through the NELAP program, which is a national environmental laboratory program. For the GCMS, I believe we have 15 compounds that we are NELAC accredited for, and that's using Tedlar bags and the loop injection method. So that was a real advantage also. So what's the future for, this stuff? It's coming at us, and if we don't keep ahead of it or take some lab-based instrumentation and move it out to the field so you guys can make better decisions, we're going to get caught behind the curve. Anyways, these are my coordinates, and if you guys have any questions or you think of something later that you want to email me about, please do. I really do appreciate the time that you took out of your busy schedules to listen to me discuss the TAGA and its capabilities to you. Any questions, Jean?
All right. Thank you so very much, Dave. We did have a number of questions that came into the Q&A window. I'll just remind the live audience, if you have a question or comment that you'd like to share with Dave, now would be a great time, if you haven't done so, to please type it into that Q&A window, which appears in the lower right corner of your screen. I'll start reading off with some of the ones that we already have submitted, and then as time permits, we'll try to go through anything else that comes into the queue. So, Dave, the first question that we got is about the TAGA's mobility. And so this particular question is actually asking, how fast can the TAGA move? And they asked from 0 to 60, but I think really the heart behind the question is more or less, how quickly can the TAGA mobilize to a site?
Well, you know, like that, it all depends, you know, like that, to where the site is, because, you know, like that, like I said, we have the TAGA in the Edison, Las Vegas, and RTP. If all the equipment is up and running and, you know, like that, it's ready to go, we right now have a GC that's not functioning in the TAGA in Las Vegas going to be worked on here shortly. But we can get out the door pretty quickly. If it's during the workday, you know, like that, it's much quicker. We can write the co-op because it's not good not to go out the door without a co-op. We have an emergency co-op for that, but as soon as we get a driver, and that assurances from our management that that they're on board, and we can emergency release without them, of course, but we have to do some paperwork in the background. So I would say within a couple hours, you know, like that, if it's during the work time. If it's not during work hours, it's going to take people coming back, you know, like that, getting drivers, stuff like this. So that may take us longer. You know, like that, it would probably take us twice as long.
Okay. And the next question asks, do you drive in level A or B in an area when you have unknown chemical concentrations?
Well, you know, when we are doing it, we're monitoring in real time. So we monitor, we do not go into hazardous, what they would consider hazardous above the STEL level, you know, like that, for any period of time. We're always in level D. We do not put, having the driver drive in a levels of protection probably would be more hazardous. If it gets above those levels, we just move our monitoring out further. There's no reasons for us to go in there and, get into levels that will be injurious to us. But remember that the air that we have in the vehicle, it's going to take a while for it to get up to the levels that are outside of the vehicle too. So that's the short answer is that we drive in level D.
Okay. So there are a sort of a cache of questions that get into accessibility to the Taga and cost. So I'm going to break them down into two groups. One, people are asking, how much does the Taga cost to use? And then the other grouping of questions, they want to know if there are commercial equivalents of the Taga out there. So if we have a non-EPA or an outside entity that wants to use a Taga on their site and they can't get to you, is there someone else out there that they can hire to do this type of work?
I'll answer the first one first. It all depends. If we're at hazard, if we're at a emergency response like Hurricane Harvey, we're being mobilized by FEMA and they pay the bill. If we're in doing it for a region, then we'll ask for compensation from the OSC or the RPM. And it will depend upon, how long we're out there and what you want to have done. And so that sort of, begs them to be efficient with the time. There used to be a time when we didn't do that, but as everybody knows, budgets are changing. So and this is also in a point of flux that, so instead of, all the prep work that may be necessary, we may only charge for, the transportation and the overtime in the field, the travel and overtime in the future. It's up to our management, and they're changing. As far as the people that can access us, the best way to do this is to work with an OSC, an RPM, because they're in the region, they'll invite us in, we don't self-deploy. And they will bring us in, and if it's a PRP, they will, charge the PRP, and then we will do the work for them. That's how it usually gets. If there is no PRP, then it goes into the Superfund account, and they have to provide us with that. As far as commercial, when I started this in 1984, I worked for a commercial firm. Subsequently, there have been no firms that have taken, gotten involved with this type of operation. There are other instruments, but they don't cover everything that we do. There's people that will talk about, real-time monitors using proton transfer reaction, mass spectroscopy that uses a drift cell. And they were down at Hurricane Harvey, but their suite of compounds may not be exactly what you're interested in, and you're not going to get triple quad, in other words, two filters, and so we may have lower detection limits. I haven't used one, so I don't know what their capabilities are. There's also iodide chemical transfer or charge transfer, time of flight mass spectrometers, but their compound list may only be ones that can actually be ionized by iodine. So, it's it all depends on what you want to do. And I think that there is a fellow that has done work with that, but if depending on whether you use a time of flight or you use a quadrupole mass spectrometer, will determine, you know, like that maybe your accuracy of correctly identifying the compound, because you can't look at fragments. So maybe you have to use, you know, like that high resolution mass spectroscopy with time of flight. However, that may not work either because they may not travel well. So the short answer is, I'm not sure.
Okay. Well, on that note, looking at that.
That's a long way around the barn.
I don't see any other questions in the queue, but I just wanted to give the audience just another minute or two if they do have additional questions or comments for you, that they can type them into that Q&A window here. And so, Dave, just to reiterate it one more time, if they are interested in the services that you talked about, how can they get in touch with you?
Email me, give me a call. You know, I got on the coordinates page. I think I gave them both my office and I can give them my cell number too if they want that. But probably the best way is to give me an email.
Okay. All right. Well, I don't see anything else coming into the question queue. So if there's nothing else, Dave, any final thoughts you'd like to leave the audience with before we begin our closeout procedures here?
Well, for the OSCs and the RPMs, you know, like that, this belongs to you guys. It's a resource for you. So if you think that you can use it, let me know.
All right. Excellent. Thank you so much, Dave. With that, I'm going to go ahead and walk through just a few final reminders before we go ahead and close out our webinar today, just a few minutes early. I wanted to thank the individuals who took time out of their busy day to join us. We did have a variety of individuals join us from EPA and a few state regulatory agencies. If you are interested in attending Internet seminars like this, you'll find them listed on the CLUIN or Cleanup Information Network. You can find us at cluin.org. But one of the easiest ways to stay on top of our upcoming webinars is to subscribe to our monthly newsletter, Tech Direct, which goes out on the first of each month. So I encourage you to visit the CLUIN website and sign up for that free newsletter so that you can learn about these free online training opportunities as soon as they become available. You can also find us on popular professional networking sites. For those of you who are looking for a copy of Dave's presentation or some of the resources that he mentioned during his talk today, I'll point you to the seminar resources page. You'll find that linked under related URLs on the middle side of your screen. If you click on the link of interest and then press the Browse To button, you'll be able to open up that website on your computer. If you happen to be one of the lucky ones replaying the archived version of today's webinar, those links on the side should still work, so you can feel free to click on and open up those sites. Again, if you're looking for Dave's contact info, you'll find it on the seminar homepage as well as contained in his slides, which are linked on that homepage. I would ask if each of you could take just a moment to fill out our online feedback form and let us know what you thought of today's delivery, both in the content that was covered as well as our method of delivery. Please know, I read each and every submission that comes in, and we count on your feedback to help continue to offer free Internet seminars like this. One of the most common questions I get are people looking for CEUs or PDHs. We don't offer those for our webinars, but many people are able to document their attendance and still get credit with their own accrediting institution. One thing I can tell you, if you fill out that feedback form for today's event, you will immediately have access to a participation certificate that you can download or print out for your own records. So when you visit the seminar feedback form link, which I'm sure you're all going to do right now, make sure that you fill it out completely and check the box at the bottom of it, which certifies you were here for the entire broadcast. As long as you check that box and send in your feedback, you'll, again, immediately have access to one of these participation certificates. Oftentimes, if you take that certificate along with either your registration email or a printout of the homepage or materials, that's enough to document your attendance. If you happen to join as part of a group from one location, each person can click the link to the feedback form, fill out their own feedback form, and get their own certificate, regardless if they registered independently or not. And that also applies to those of you replaying the recorded version. You can still follow those links to the feedback form after the live broadcast and share your thoughts with us on the archive. So with that, I want to thank everyone so very much for joining us. I want to thank Dave for taking time out of his very busy schedule to chime in and deliver another TAGA presentation. And then as noted, today's session was recorded. You'll automatically get an email in about 1 to 2 weeks when the archive is available for on-demand playback. And with that, that will go ahead and formally...